You're listening to Song Exploder, where musicians take apart their songs and piece by piece tell the story of how they were made. I'm Hrishikesh Hirway. Song Exploder is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Thanks to Indeed for sponsoring this episode. When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one, just meet your match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Song Exploder listeners will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at indeed.com/songexploder. Terms and conditions apply. This episode contains explicit language. In 1993, Liz Phair released her debut album, Exile in Guyville. It was an instant hit, critically and commercially. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies. Spin and The Village Voice named it Album of the Year. And soon after, Rolling Stone put her on the cover of their magazine. Now, 25 years later, Exile in Guyville is being reissued as a deluxe box set with new photos, essays, and Liz Phair's original four-track cassette recordings. In this episode, Liz and Exile in Guyville's producer, Brad Wood, look back to tell the story of the creation of one of the songs on the album, Divorce Song.
But you've never been a waste of my time. It's never been a drag. So take a deep breath and count back from 10, and maybe you'll be all right.
I'm Liz Phair. I don't remember when I wrote Divorce Song, but I remember the evening that inspired it. I must have been a sophomore or junior in college. I was dating a guy at Oberlin. It was one of those things where we were friends, but we were kind of hooking up. So it was like a non-defined kind of relationship. And he had this little blue Miata, which stood out on campus. Like, you know, everyone wanted to ride in Shane's Miata. You know, like nobody had that in the middle of Ohio. And one night we went for a ride in the Miata, and I think we drove through cornfields. The way that evening ends is we were thinking about stopping at like a motel, and I think we actually went in and discussed getting a motel room, and then I think we were like, nah. So it was kind of like this night where I didn't know how I felt about him, I didn't know how he felt about me, but we had a really good time together, and I wanted to write about all the little in-between moments that people have with a relationship where you disagree about things or just the ordinary things that happen that if you're in that relationship are incredibly dramatic and they mean so much. I wrote pretty quickly. I always felt that it was really important to take that kernel of raw emotion and grab it, capture it. So I was writing all these little songs, but I didn't record it until long after college. I literally wouldn't play them for anyone. I wouldn't show them, record them, nothing. And I wrote with no amplification, mostly. I didn't want anyone to hear. So I would play on an electric guitar with my head bent over so I could hear the strings. And I think that's why my chords are interesting, because when you're just playing them with no amplification, it might sound very good. And then when you stick it through an amplifier, you can hear every note, the ones that are dissonant as well as the ones that sound good. That was a learning process, how to get over the fact that I wrote these things virtually silently. I had a four-track, a microphone, an electric guitar, and a little PV amp. Four-tracks are pretty basic. That was what appealed to me about them. You just stick the cassette in, press play, and record. I would go to the house of my parents' friends who were out of town, and I would swap watering their plants and taking their dog out or something to be able to set up a little recording studio in their home. I didn't want my parents to hear the words that I was singing either. Like, that was another thing I had to cover up. I was saying some pretty raunchy stuff in the lyrics, so it was important that I just felt unselfconscious.
For a separate room, it was
I didn't work very hard on it because I thought I was a visual artist who just happened to write songs on the side. I didn't think I was a musician. So I put all my professionalism into my visual art and very little of it into my music. And I think that allowed me to not overwork something. And I knew that that was a tendency of mine from visual art. I had ruined so many drawings just by overworking them. So I pretty much let the music be quick. It was spontaneous. I didn't second guess myself a lot.
Liz Phair used the name Girly Sound for these recordings.
Girly Sound was a art provocative piece in my mind. This is learned from Oberlin that the young female voice carries the least authority in society. And so I wanted to see if you had a little girl voice, which I sort of did, what you could get away with saying. Would anyone listen? Would they care? Would it matter if you said really shocking things in a really girlish voice? Because you think of like the most innocent things. You think of, you know, sunny day, little girls, you know, and like I just wanted to completely upend that. Because having been a little girl, I know that they are devilish and fascinating and conniving little creatures. Like, they are fully prepared to participate in society, just maybe not always given the chance.
And you put it in my hand, a loaded gun, and told me not to fire it. When you did the things you said up to me,
so I made one cassette of songs and two copies, and that was it.
Hi, I'm Brad Wood. I heard the Girly Sound tapes. That was at John Henderson's apartment. John Henderson lived in Chicago like we all did and ran a couple of small indie labels, put out some really cool music. And he mentioned that there's this woman he wants to put a record out with, and I was running a recording studio up the block from where he lived.
John Henderson, he ran his label from that apartment, and he let me live there because I wanted to get out of my parents' house, and he gave me like super cheap rent, and I think his idea was that I would help put like CDs in the, like I was going to help mail, because I have this flashback memory of him instructing me how to do that, but then I also have a memory that I never did that.
I walked down to Hendy's house, and Liz had already gone to sleep. And John played 8 or 9 songs. I remember Divorce Song specifically. And that song resonated with me more than any other song she's written. I just was struck by the lyrics and the unusual chord structure. And I'll never forget walking home with like this nervous calculation. How can I help make this happen? Like this is it. I was going to be the engineer for that session. And he wanted to book time at the studio with some musicians. I'd be the drummer and the engineer. And that's really how we proceeded initially. John made it clear that he and Liz were going to produce it, or just he.
John, he was such a music head, and he did play all this great music. He was constantly like, listen to this, listen to this, and listen to this. You know, this is another feature of Guyville. Guys were constantly lecturing me about what good music was and like what band I should listen to. And it was just like constant school. He was really adamant in the studio about what he wanted to do and what he didn't want to do. And I felt suddenly what I hadn't really cared about before, I felt like he was taking too much ownership over it. And I didn't like at all the sensation of him telling me what could and couldn't be on my songs. And I kind of woke up. Like, I didn't react until the song itself was being manipulated by someone who was essentially telling me that he knew better than I did. And that triggered something in me.
And I do have a really strong memory of not feeling that the music that we were recording was syncing up with your songs very well.
You know, I'd been working in visual art for a long time. I wasn't naive to the ways of being creative. I was just naive to the ways of making music. And this thing just sort of like this defiant person came up out of me that was like, no, now you're fucking with my shit. I could have and should have noticed that ahead of time. I just wasn't paying attention. So I split with John Henderson, and I didn't want to do it anymore. I don't think he wanted to do it either. I think I was not the Eliza Doolittle he was hoping for, you know? Like, I was a feral little beast that was, like, not learning, you know? Like, And I was fine with that. I'm like, yeah, that's right, you know?
I was disappointed that we weren't going to record anymore. So I called John and asked if I could get a number for Liz, and I called her at her parents' house. Eventually, we did connect enough to agree to record again.
My songs from Girly Sound, I never thought about recording them in the studio. I never thought about what they would sound like. And I think that's why I chose to use a template. In my mind, I was thinking like an academic. If you don't know how to make a record, pick the very best record and then deconstruct it. Figure out how they did what they did. Study it. Learn from the greats. And then do your own interpretation of that. So the template that I went with was sort of the most audacious template, which was Exile on Main Street, the Rolling Stones' double album. It was a presumptuous thing to say, like, oh, I'm going to do my song-by-song response to the greatest record of all time. That's when I started making charts where I had, like, all of my songs next to all of their songs. In a lot of ways, it let me feel like I was in control of something that I really wasn't, that I really didn't know what I was doing. It gave me a focus for my nervous energy. And Ventilator Blues is the corresponding song to Divorce Song. And what I got from that song was tension, and everyone's got to release the tension. Ventilator Blues, like, things get, like, so intense and people just keep slogging through life. When yo. So with Divorce Song, it's a lyrical corresponding thing. That was like what it is when you're in a relationship. You're just slogging through together. There are times that you blow up and fight with each other, and it doesn't have to mean it's the end of the relationship necessarily. You just have to ventilate. So we had a lot of choices to make. What arrangement do you put on just a guitar and a vocal?
There was no clear idea for most of the songs initially what was going to be hung on it. And so I specifically wanted to make sure that the song sounded good as just guitar and voice. When Liz first came into the studio, we plugged into different guitar amps to see what worked. And Liz was most comfortable playing through her PV Backstage, which is an inexpensive...
Portable,
small little amp.
I do remember there was like a tussle about the PV amp, and I just didn't want to let go of it. The Liz doll came complete with a set, and you had to figure out how to make something tasteful with it.
It has this bizarre reverb on it. But what we would do is put it through a chorus pedal. It has a stereo output, so one cable would come out and go into Liz's PV amp, and then we'd plug in a second amp. So she would play one guitar part through two amplifiers, and then we could pan it left, right.
I remember sitting there, and you would solo my vocal for some technical reason. And when I asked for a separate room, it was late at night, and we've been driving since noon. And when I first heard my voice back over the big speakers, I wanted to die. Every second that that vocal was up there in that room, I was sitting on the couch like in a state of seizure.
So on this song in particular, Liz at least sang two times.
I would have stayed in your bed for the rest of my life just to prove I was right, that it's harder to be friends than lovers.
I think my voice was too thin. And when you double a vocal track, any mistakes, any foibles will just sort of get lost in the wash.
But when I mixed it, we only used the double just on the choruses. At that time, I had more confidence in her singing ability than she had. You know, I was going to sort of push my agenda. And my agenda with this song specifically was that a song so harrowing lyrically that's painting such a bleak picture that unfortunately all of us probably at some time experience, whether it's divorce or just a relationship dying, I thought that it was best communicated in as stark a setting as possible.
But when you said that I wasn't worth talking to, I had to take your word on that.
I had really specific ideas for the rhythm parts for this song. And a lot of that comes from Liz's guitar style. She does a lot of accents off the beat, doesn't play on the downbeat. The really obvious thing to do would be to play a drum pattern that hits those accents. But I had been taught never overplay. One of the things that Rolling Stones are so good at is Charlie Watts' drumming.
It's very vivid to me, you extolling the virtues of Charlie Watts.
And so with Divorce Song, I wanted to have an element that complemented and pushed further the accented strumming that Liz does on that song. And that's where the percussion comes in. What makes Divorce Song sound like a Stone song, in my mind, is that it's got Shakers and Kielbasa playing this odd accent. And every time I hear that start, it sounds like Jimmy Miller, the producer of the Stones, playing the cowbell on Honky Tonk Women. The whole song starts out with the cowbell, and then Charlie comes in with the beat. Pat, pat. That's what makes a Stone song for so many people. It's the thing that you would hear first. And we don't have to have a bunch of big rock guitars and bluesy chords. You just need some of these very essential, it's like the whiff of, it's like a vapor of a Rolling Stones essence, you know?
Yeah, you just sort of like, you spritz in the air and you walk through it. All the wicked guitar parts on Guyville are Casey Rice. Casey Rice, to me, was like the full rock flavor. He was your engineer, correct?
Yes, Casey was an engineer at the studio. He had started, I think, that year, 92 or late 91. And Casey Rice plays Smokin' Leads.
Smokin' Leads.
He doesn't play for the entire song, just waits for 2.5 minutes. And then we rock it out. Casey's guitar comes in.
Part of what I loved about recording Guyville is that people dropped by to see Brad all the time.
People would drop by to see Casey Rice.
Either way, there was like a nice way to record because there was always like new people that just might show up. You don't know who's coming to the studio that night while you're working.
And so John Casey Awesome is the harmonica player. I think John Casey Awesome was a friend of Casey's. So John Casey Awesome came in to play and we said, can you play harmonica on this? And he said, sure, I can play harmonica on whatever you want. And we just recorded him one take. From the beginning of the song to the end, he just blew his brains out, just kept going and going and going.
Yeah, he's playing like full velocity the entire song.
Never stopped for a second.
He never stopped, and he's like at 11 the entire time. And at the end, the outro, he really was killing it. So we're like, that's all we do.
All we used was the outro, and that's the only part of the song where me on drums, I go to an open hi-hat and play a more traditional drum beat, and we rock it out. I'm playing bass on the song. After the second chorus, it comes back to a very short verse, and she sings.
And the license said you had to stick around until I was dead. But if you're tired of looking at my face, I guess I already am.
And that's the only time, I think, on the song that references a marriage, references a contract, which is being broken, and hence the title, Divorce Song. And I play way up the neck on the bass and abandon all the rhythm. Everything clears out for this short period.
But if you're tired of looking at my face, I guess I already am.
I wanted the bass to be fragile. Because Liz wasn't going to be fragile. She's brave enough to sing these words. I wanted something musical to be delicate. And so have it be the big beefy bass that suddenly just goes up the neck and decides to just be fragile.
When you're in a car with someone, that's a pretty intimate environment. it's ripe for awkward interaction. And for me, Divorce Song, the entire thing is about that tension in that kind of, you're looking at him, he's looking at you, you're both having totally different thoughts about each other, and yet you're like stuck in this small confined space together. I had a fatalist view of love at that point. I felt like things often fell apart and it was hard to keep a relationship together. Divorce Song is really about micro moments where you really want something to work out, but you find your mouth speaking words as if it's not going to. Like you dare not hope. And you have these like sensitive feelings for someone, and yet you're sort of outwardly convincing yourself and everyone around you that it's probably not gonna work out, it doesn't really matter. I didn't make these songs to start a career. I made these songs because they were my way of understanding the world. They were my therapy.
And now, here's Divorce Song by Liz Phair in its entirety.
Separate room. It was late at night, and we've been driving since noon. But if I'd known how that would sound to you, I would have stayed in your bed for the rest of my life, just to prove I was right. That it's harder to be friends than lovers, and you shouldn't try to mix the two. 'Cause if you do it and you're still unhappy, then you know that the problem is you. And it's true that I stole your lighter, and it's also true that I lost the map. But when you said that I wasn't worth talking to, to take your word on that. But if you'd known how that would sound to me, you would have taken it back and boxed it up and buried it in the ground. Boxed it up and buried it in the ground. Boxed it up and buried it in the ground. Burned it up and thrown it away. You put in my hand a loaded gun and then told me not to fire it. When you did the things you said were up to me, and then accused me of trying to fuck it up. But you've never been a waste of my time. It's never been a drag. So take a deep breath and count back from 10, and maybe you'll be alright. License said you had to stick around until I was dead. But if you're tired of looking at my face, I guess I already am. But you've never been a waste of my time. It's never been a drag. So take a deep breath and count back from 10, and maybe you'll be alright.
Visit songexploder.net to learn more about Liz Phair and producer Brad Wood. You'll also find links to buy the song and the 25th anniversary box set. Song Exploder is sponsored by DistroKid. If you're an independent artist, DistroKid is a great way to get your music distributed. You get unlimited uploads, and you get to keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. There are more than a million artists, including me, who have used DistroKid to get their music into all the major streaming services. Spotify, Apple Music, TikTok, everywhere. The DistroKid app is now available on iOS and Android. Go to the app or Play Store to download it now. And for 10% off your first year's membership, go to distrokid.com/VIP/songexploder. If you heard about a sponsor in this episode and you want to learn more, you can always go to songexploder.net/sponsors to find all the current offers available to Song Exploder listeners. This episode was produced by me, along with Christian Kunz, with help from intern Olivia Wood. Special thanks to Mac Burris. The illustrations on the Song Exploder website are by Carlos Lerma. Song Exploder is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a collective of fiercely independent podcasts. You can learn about all of the shows at radiotopia.fm. You can find Song Exploder on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Song Exploder. You can also find all the past episodes of the show on the Song Exploder website or on Apple Podcasts or Radio Public. My name is Hrishikesh Hirway. Thanks for listening. Radiotopia.